Avalon County Entertainment System. Channel Select, Avalon Broadcasting System, Channel 17. Program Start. Friday, October 28th, 2411. West New Excellent Beach, Mambo Island No. 5, Funkatron. They had been staying in the beach house at the far end of West New Excellent Beach for 3 weeks by this time, the movie star and his lady friend. They were popular with the locals, these two, because they were laid back and friendly and good tippers, and they seemed to have taken to the spirit of the place within minutes of arriving. White-skinned in a way that somehow neither tanned nor burned in the climate of the Mambo Islands, the woman did nice things to a black bikini, which, sometimes with a beach towel tied around her waist, sometimes not, was mainly what she had worn since arriving. That kind of thing also helped relations with the natives. No one on Mambo Island No. 5 really knew what they were there for, and nobody thought it his business to ask. Discretion was part of the business in Funkatron's thriving worldwide hospitality industry, and nowhere was that more so than in the Mambos, that equatorial ocean paradise where the elite, and more or less everybody else, went when they did not wish to meet or greet. Possibly the movie star was just enjoying some downtime before shooting began on his next project. If so, he had chosen the right place in which, and the right company with which, to do it. Now the movie star stood on the veranda of the rented beach house, puffing contentedly on a big cigar and looking out to sea. An aloha shirt, emblazoned with brilliant red parrots and green palm trees against a background of vivid sea blue, was stretched taut across his barrel chest. Off in the distance, beyond the combers coming up the pure white beach and the vacationers playing in the surf, he could see the only flaw in this scene of tranquil fun he had inhabited with great comfort for the last 22 days. On the horizon, barely visible, a wisp of black smoke rose from the sea. Actually, he knew, from the island that was just hidden behind the curve of the sea. That was Mambo No. 1 over there, the largest island in the chain and the location of the archipelago's central transportation hub. And though no one else on Mambo No. 5 had noticed it yet, the movie star knew that smoke meant big trouble had just kicked off in the Mambo Islands. The beach house door opened behind him, and his female companion emerged onto the veranda. She'd shed her usual black bikini in favor of a much more extensive, and yet in its way no less body-accentuating, set of midnight blue tactical gear, all straps and zippered pockets and holsters. Her normally carefree air was muted and serious as she said, "It's started. TAC Team 2 finally identified the strike team, but they moved in too late to prevent activation." She scowled. "I knew I should have gone with them. Anyway, it's up to us now." The movie star nodded with a look of evident satisfaction. "It's about damn time," he said. Unbuttoning his shirt with methodical care, he hung it on the back of a deck chair, then walked down the 6 steps to the beach. At the water's edge, people were starting to notice the huge figure wading chest-deep toward them through the 20-fathom-deep channel, separating their island from Mambo No. 1. Alarm was spreading up and down the beach. Soon it would progress to panic. The woman, Beatrice Watanabe, experts of justice code name Domino, descended the steps to stand next to him, surveying the scene through a miniature pair of electro-binoculars. "Civvies are clearing out in good order," she noted approvingly. "Good. I hate having to do crowd control. I've got 5, 6 landing craft inbound, about 500 yards out. Say 200 goons."
"They're all yours, B," said the movie star, standing bare-chested on the sand as he faced down his approaching foe with intent eyes. "I'm gonna have my hands full with the main event."
"Roger that," Domino said. Drawing and priming her twin blaster pistols, she leaned and kissed his cheek. "Be careful." The movie star smirked.
"I'm always careful," he said. With a laugh, Domino moved off to meet the enemy's amphibious troops. Out in the channel, more of the approaching Big Fire K unit started rising from the water as it climbed the shallowing slope toward the beach. Shortly, it would be within weapons range of the beach houses, cabanas, and still withdrawing crowd of civilians. Just before that time came, the movie star gave its combat intelligence something else to think about. Keeping his eyes locked on the empty mockery of its face, he drew hard on his cigar, making the coal glow brightly. Then, flicking the butt into the surf, he let out, along with a cloud of smoke, a gigantic noise, somewhere between the roar of a huge and savage animal and the shriek of a vast and ill-maintained door. When it began, this sound seemed entirely too vast for its utterer to contain it. When it ended, though, Lensman Gojira Nakajima was fully 150 feet tall and looked equal to the job of encompassing any sound he cared to. The K-unit wasn't impressed. That wasn't within its programming. But the Black Hoods just coming ashore from their landing craft were. Domino heard a few of them blurting out appropriate expletives before she, in turn, gave them something else to think about. And then they were much too busy having a gunfight to stand around and watch as their giant robot threw down with the king of the kaiju. Half a dozen vacationing Funkotroning with video cameras weren't, though, and the resulting footage, edited and presented as part of a big-time TV documentary, would eventually win a Golden Galaxy for battlefield cinematography. Flying Yak Studios and Bacon Comics Group, in association with the International Police Organization and Avalon Broadcasting System, present Weapon of Choice, a Lensman, the Brave and the Bold special event. Wednesday, November 2nd, 2411. Chengdu, New Avalon. Griffin wasn't sure what had possessed the local branch of the Han to raid a middle-echelon Chinese restaurant in downtown New Avalon at midday on a Wednesday, but he was sure he didn't appreciate it. Particularly since, as he was lunching alone, he'd have to take care of it himself. The comedy value would have been much higher if he'd been here with any one of his usual lunch partners, particularly Kara, say, or Cassie. Then he could have just sat back, relaxed, and enjoyed the mayhem. As it was, he was going to have to get up out of his corner booth, leave his frankly excellent Hunan-style chicken to get cold, and teach a few lessons. If he were honest, he'd much rather have stayed where he was and finished both the dish and the Cornet Scientifer article on last week's Funkatron incident, which had a truly excellent front-page photo of Gojira doing his thing. He sighed, folded the paper, and put it down on the table, then made ready to rise from his seat. Before he reached his feet, however, he found himself facing down with one of the anonymous ninja of the hand and his miniature crossbow.
"You should know better than to place yourself at the disadvantage of sitting in a booth, Griffin-san," said the ninja. "Today it will cost you."
Griffin gave the man a skeptical look. "A pistol crossbow? Really? If you put a hole in my nice new War Machine shirt, I'm going to be really annoyed. I just bought it yesterday."
"The hole in your shirt will be the least of your work," said the ninja,
and then he paused for a moment to look down at the two gleaming metal points that had just emerged from his chest.
"Oh,"
he said, and then sagged, slid forward off the blades, and fell face down to the floor. The ninja's fall revealed a woman who had been standing behind him. She was not the kind of woman who particularly stood out in a place like this. Average height or a little bit shorter, slender build, nondescript dark clothes with a dressy black leather jacket. She appeared to be 20-ish, pretty but not prepossessing, with long dark hair and a calm, perhaps slightly too calm, mien. At first glance, the only really striking thing about her was the color of her eyes, a remarkable sort of jade green. On second glance, there were also the gleaming metal blades protruding from both of her hands, one pair of which she had just thrust, rather casually, to judge from the rest of her stance, through the body of the ninja with the crossbow. Behind her, the rest of the ninja strike team lay scattered like very large, discarded action figures. Restaurant patrons and staff hid behind partitions and seats, peeking tentatively out to see what was going on. Hello, Benjamin, the woman said, her voice low and slightly husky. With a metallic sound, her claws retracted into the backs of her hands, leaving small vertical wounds between her knuckles that closed and vanished within a second or so. Griffin blinked at her in profound surprise, then recovered his aplomb and said cheerfully, "Well, Laura Kinney, as I live and breathe, I haven't seen you for dog's years." He gestured to the opposite side of the booth. "Have a seat. How have you been? What's going on lately?" Laura sat, folded her hands loosely in front of her on the table, and regarded him solemnly for a moment before saying, "I need a favor." Griffin smiled nostalgically. "Good to see you haven't changed. Straight to the point. What do you need?" "I want you to complete me," Laura replied without a hint of humor. There was a momentary silence while Griffin gave that remark the consideration it deserved. Then he took a sip of his tea and said, "Now, coming from an ordinary woman, I'd interpret that as a very flattering metaphor. But when you say something like that, I know you must mean it in some startlingly literal way." An oh-I-get-it look came onto his face. "Ah, of course. We're talking about the bones thing, aren't we?" Laura nodded. "There are 5 organizations in the galaxy today which may conceivably have the scientific and technical resources to complete the Weapon X process. Yours is the only one I feel I can trust." Griffin took another drink and frowned thoughtfully. "You know," he said after a few moments' thought, "it seems to me we burned down one such outfit back in the day because of certain ethical reservations we harbored about the whole idea." This got another nod. "We did." "So why," he wondered, "are you now seeking me out and asking me to perform such a painful, invasive, potentially fatal procedure upon your, if I may say, externally unimprovable person?" That drew a very small smile, one which became a trifle wry as she replied, "Suffice it to say that I have grown tired of reattaching limbs." Griffin nodded. "Fair enough. Please understand, however, that I am not an actual practicing mad scientist at this time." "You must employ several," said Laura, deadpan again. Griffin grinned. "You've got me there. Okay, let me finish my lunch and we'll see what we can arrange. Have you eaten? The lo mein here is fantastic. Garçon!" An hour later, Special Technologies Computer-Aided Enrichment Center, IPO headquarters. Skuldraven here didn't bother to conceal her delight. "Sure I can do that," she said. "And contrary to Big Chief Gloomy's assumptions, it doesn't necessarily have to be painful or dangerous." She shot a look at Griffin, who shrugged. "Well, did you think I was just going to do it the way they did it 400 years ago? They used drills, for Pete's sake. Drills!" She shook her head in disgust. "Stone knives and bearskins. We have nanites now." "I can withstand a great deal of discomfort," Laura assured her calmly, but Skuld shook her head again, reassuringly this time. "It's great that you can, but it's better that you won't have to," Skuld said. "Honestly, there's no need for it to hurt at all nowadays. I just need to recalibrate the nanosurgeons we use for our tactical agents' standard ferroceramic bone reinforcement treatments. Adamantium is trickier to work with, and it'll cost some astonishing number of credits, but if I don't care about that, why should you?" she added with a grin. Then, becoming businesslike but still cheerful, she said, "Do you want to get started right away?" Laura nodded. "As soon as it is convenient for you, Dr. Ravenhair." Skuld grinned. "If we waited for that, it'd never get done. So no time like the present. Wheatley, hold my calls." "Righto," said a synthetic West Country accent from somewhere unseen. "Now, give your jacket to Ben, that's what he's here for, and get comfortable on the diagnostic table." As Laura complied, Skuld started tweaking controls and sensor heads above the slightly sinister-looking table-slash-bed, keeping up a running commentary as she did so. "I'm going to have to run a bunch of scans and make sure you're properly prepped before the main event. Probably take 2 or 3 hours." "Oh," she added, as if in passing, "and of course once the IVs are in and the treatment's actually started, you will have to keep absolutely still for 12 hours.
"I can do that," Laura agreed immediately. "Thank you."
"As for you," Skuld said to Griffin, "you can wait over there, or you can come back at 4:30. Your call. There's not going to be a lot to see."
He waited over there.
There was indeed not a lot to see, but the coat rack in chief stuck around anyway, staying out of the way and smiling an inner smile as Skuld did her thing. For the next 3 hours, Laura lay uncomplaining and still as the goddess of technology scanned, measured, prodded, sequenced, cross-matched, temporarily immunosuppressed, and electrostatically neutralized her.
"Hmm," said Skuld at one point early in the scanning process. "Existing bionics. Quality blades. Half-assed install." She glanced at her patient's face, smiling apologetically.
"No offense, but your original augmenters were hacks. We can do way better. Do these things just cut holes in your hand every time you use them?"
Laura nodded.
"Jesus," Skuld sighed, rolling her eyes. "Amateurs. Some people should just not be allowed to make super soldiers."
"You have no idea," Laura replied.
The rest of the process passed mostly in silence. Eventually, Skuld finished the preliminaries, dusted off her hands symbolically, and declared, "Okay, I've got all the data I need. Now it'll take me about an hour to set everything up, and we're in business." She pointed to Griffin. "And we need to make ourselves scarce before the procedure starts, because before the needles come out, it has to be clean room alpha in here. So if you two have anything you need to say or anything, now's the time."
Griffin approached the table, stopping a hygienically discreet distance away, and grinned.
"You don't get service this speedy just anywhere," he said.
Laura smiled slightly, maybe even, Skuld thought, a little shyly, and replied,
"Benjamin, thank you. I will do my best to repay..."
"Hey, whoa there," he said, holding up a hand. "We see each other for the first time in all these years, and you want to start talking about debts? Forget about it. Once this is done, if you want to come help me defend the galaxy, you've got a place. If you don't, that's fine too." He smiled wryly. "I know what happens to people who try to fence you in."
She chuckled and put up a hand. He held up his own about a foot away, then made a peace sign and allowed himself to be ushered from the room by Skuld.
"Just when I think I know your history," she mock grumbled as she led the way up the hall to the control room, "another new challenger appears from somewhere in the mists of time."
"Huh, hardly," Griffin replied. "No history of that kind there, I assure you. When we met, she was a 15-year-old assassin doll, and I was the galaxy's anger manager."
"You haven't said anything there that helps your case," Skuld pointed out.
"Please. Seriously, just no."
Skuld keyed them into the control room and seated herself at the main console, powering up the systems. Magnifications of the procedure table from several different angles rezzed up around the direct view afforded by the room's panoramic window.
"Okay. Laura, can you hear me?"
5x5, Laura replied.
"Excellent. I'm starting the decon cycle and configuring the nanosystems. Just be cool, and I'll be back with you presently."
"Roger."
Skuld shut off the mic and turned to Griffin, who had taken another seat by the door.
"She seems like a sweetheart now. Kind of quiet, and she talks like a Vulcan, but..."
Griffin nodded. "Yeah, you'd hardly know now that she was raised in an environment that made Arkham Asylum seem like Chuck E. Cheese's. I had a little to do with that, but not in that way."
"Tell me about it," Skuld said as she started working on the nano configuration. "When and where?"
"It was the fall of 2335. I just left New Japan. Didn't know where I was going, what I was doing. I'd abandoned my life in Mega Tokyo to chase Largo off-world and then lost his trail out in the terminus. He chuckled darkly. Whenever I find myself in the terminus in those days, it all tended to go wrong in a hurry. Monday, October 7th, 2335. Omega.
It could be argued that going to Omega was a mistake. Partly that's because it can always be argued that going to Omega is a mistake. But in this case, it's more to do with the obvious fact that I wasn't very likely to find Largo there. To be fair, though, it wasn't Largo himself I was looking for. It was the vibrations Largo made in the web of illicit connections to the dark underside of Genom. Wherever the man went within the colossal structure of the company, his presence made things happen that were more secret and sinister than ordinary dealings. Secret laboratories and deniable operations sprang up in close proximity to wherever he established his headquarters, the better to enhance security by having shorter lines of communication. Largo was a control freak. He liked to have direct interaction with his darkest of black projects. That was what had brought me to the terminus, the rustlings and whisperings of some new atrocity that had Genom Black Operations' greasy fingerprints at its edges. It was said that there was a nameless organization, newly established, or possibly just newly revealed, on Omega, which operated independent of the three major mercenary criminal syndicates that ruled the place in an uneasy balance. This organization conducted no operations itself, maintained no army, and cared nothing for the usual activities of such outfits. They didn't run drugs or guns or slaves from place to place within the tottering United Galactica. All they did, so the word on the street went, was control, maintain, and rent out the galaxy's deadliest weapon, a creature so vicious, so powerful, and so bloodthirsty that it, like its masters, had no need of a name. The murmurs I had heard in the underworld called it simply, and a bit melodramatically, X. I thought the room behind the noodle shop in the 4th District was going to be just another way station on a longer investigative chain. I didn't realize until I was inside that my inquiries had attracted more attention than I'd expected at this stage. I came to Omega looking for a connection between X, the growing reputation of which had all the hallmarks of a Genom Black project, and Largo's recent relocation from New Japan. Instead, though I didn't realize it at that moment, I was about 30 seconds from encountering X itself.
Griffin knew as soon as the door closed behind him that this wasn't going to be a straightforward meeting with an informant after all. At least 33% of him had been expecting that. He waited for a few seconds, eyes scanning the dusty, mostly empty storeroom to see what would happen next. Eclipse troopers? Vat-grown cyborg assassins? Ninja? Instead, the only out-of-place thing he saw there was a single person, small and dark-clad, sitting on a box in the middle of the room. At the sound of the door, she looked up, meeting his eyes. Hers, he noticed instantly, were the most amazing shade of green.
"You shouldn't have come here," she said softly.
She rose to her feet, hands hanging slack at her sides. Standing, she could have been no more than 5 feet or so tall, slightly built, with long, dark, slightly disordered hair. She was dressed in anonymous black tactical gear, a bit incongruously, given that she couldn't have been more than 14 or 15 years old. "You're telling me," Griffin replied wryly. "You should probably get out of here," he told her. "I'm pretty sure I'm about to get ambushed."
"You're right," the girl said in the same hushed voice. "You are."
She took 2 brisk walking strides toward him, then broke into a trot, then a run. 15 feet out, she sprang, silent and expressionless, with metal blades suddenly sprouting from the backs of her hands.
"Oh, for—" Griffin said, sounding more outraged than anything else.
In hindsight, I shouldn't have been that surprised. I mean, this whole thing involved me proceeding from the assumption that X was one of Largo's weird science black projects, and he always made them look like girls. Sure, the stories I had heard painted the creature as about 20 feet tall and possibly related to the xenomorphs of Acheron, but I should have known that there was likely to be a certain degree of exaggeration involved there.
What followed was the most exciting fight the residents of the 4th District had witnessed in some time, miles beyond the usual 15-second gunfights and cursory shivings they tended to indulge in themselves. Over the course of maybe a third of an hour, the silent girl in black and the markedly less silent man in gray and brown rampaged across half the district, through shops and storage areas, up staircases and down turbo shafts, collaterally laying waste to almost everything before them as they passed. The double blades in the girl's hands, and a pair in her feet, Griffin found out about with an expletive-producing unexpectedness, seemed to be able to cut through pretty much anything, to judge by the ease with which they parted stanchions, carved slots in durasteel bulkheads, and shredded any obstacle he might contrive to put in her way. She had seemed surprised, the first indication of anything in the way of human feelings she might have possessed, when she'd failed to cut his swords on first parry. In fact, the phenomenon seemed to unnerve her out of proportion to the problem it caused her. From that point on, she regarded him with a hint of something that might have been a distant, muted cousin of fear, far in the back of her jade-green eyes. She said nothing, engaged in no banter or smack talk, didn't even cry out in consternation or pain when he scored a hit. That happened only occasionally anyway, and was how he learned the second interesting fact about her, which was that she regenerated like nobody's business, much faster than he did, as it happened, which meant that even with her inability to sever his swords, she stood a reasonable statistical chance of winning the fight eventually. The girl was very young, but wily and obviously well-trained. As he applied all his own training, experience, energy, and initiative to staying alive, Griffin could believe that she really was the product of an intensive development effort upon which massive resources had been expended. He wondered as to the motives of her makers. Surely it couldn't be profit, despite the colossal sums he'd heard they charged their clients for the use of her. If their only motivation was money, they must have had a giant heap of it to start with. That fit with the profile of a Genon Black project, too. Profit wasn't the motivation behind those. Largo's inexplicable inbuilt drive to create ever more powerful and elegant tools of destruction, or make his underlings create them, was. And that was really the only thing Griffin could think of that explained this strange and highly specialized little creature. At length they found themselves, ragged, sweat-soaked, blood-smeared, in some sort of abandoned industrial facility left over from the days when Omega had been a mining and metals refining station. It was a grimy, dusty, ill-lit, sprawling space littered with discarded crucibles, rust-frozen chain falls, and crumbling sheets of printout flimsy from long darkened process control systems. Griffin thought it had probably been used for making tritanium ingots back when the asteroid that had become Omega still had tritanium ore to yield. That would have been at least 200 years ago, and when the ore ran out, the processors had simply abandoned the facility. Here, at last, the girl in black made a mistake.
She came at me from above, diving down from the top of one of the derelict crucibles, maybe 20 feet high. It was the wrong choice. The height differential between us was just exactly enough for me to sense her coming and have time to react, but not enough for her to adapt to my response. The whole fight, we'd both been like chess players, always trying to see two moves ahead. Now, by her choice of launching point, she'd cut herself down to one and given me three. Either she misjudged the height or how far into the zone I was by that point. We both had pretty good zanshin, and her training was impeccable, but I had the experience. At that point, I basically had three options. I could refuse the engagement entirely and fade into the industrial jumble. I knew by then that she had spectacular tracking abilities, though. She'd find me, and she wouldn't make this mistake a second time. I could take her head and, probably, end the whole matter then and there. Or I could try to cripple her in some manner not immediately fatal and improvise. Of the three, the first was right out, and the third was fraught with uncertainty. The smart money was on option two. But I couldn't do it. I might have been little more than a vaguely man-shaped mass of bitterness and disillusion by that point, but I had standards, damn it, and they did not involve the decapitation of teenage girls, even homicidal ones. As it was, I had to steel myself considerably to do what I had to do for option three. It might not be instantly fatal, but it was definitely going to be brutal and ruthless. I had to tell myself sternly, "This is not a girl, muchacho. It's just a weapon that happens to look like one." But even then I didn't really believe it, and it cost me something deep and private to do what I did next.
X realized her mistake a millisecond after committing it. Knowing what she would have done if he had been the one to make it, she fully expected the next second to be her last. She went into it with her eyes wide open, unflinching, accepting her fate as due and proper payment for such an amateurish blunder. As such, she was pleasantly surprised, in an abstract kind of way, when, instead of taking her head or filleting her up the middle as he ought to have done, her target, with one flashing arc of his long blade, beautifully, even artistically done, relieved her of her outstretched right arm and both legs. She hit the deck plates a short way beyond him in a surprisingly small spray of blood, all things considered. Griffin turned, his face hard, to stop himself weeping at what he'd just had to do, and pinned her remaining hand to the deck with his wakizashi before she could raise it or, however improbable such a maneuver might seem, try to get up. On one knee before her, with his right hand still on the wakizashi's grip and his katana across her throat in his left, he asked her sharply, "Where's Largo?" Her face wore an expression that was as much surprise, presumably that even she could feel this much pain, as anything else, but at that question a note of real puzzlement was added to the mix. Looking into her eyes, Griffin saw that she generally did not know what the hell he was on about. If Largo was responsible for her making, and if he'd ever chosen to inspect his creation, he'd done so without introducing himself. "Damn," he muttered. "All right, here's what we're going to..." At that moment, the chronometer strapped to the one wrist the girl had left started to vibrate, pulsing gently, almost inaudibly, but that they were so close together now. Griffin glanced down at it. 00:00:00. He made surprised eye contact with the girl again, then looked more closely at her. Taking his hand off the wakizashi's grip for a moment, he darted it to her left ear before she could recoil out of his reach and snatched the tactical combud from it. "Danger," his Zanshin whispered. He turned, looking up and back along the line of fire, and saw that the upper catwalks and rafter of the room were full of silhouetted figures with the faintly glowing red eyes of tactical optics. There had to be 20 or 30 of them up there. His mind, still running at full military power, ran through the possibilities. Blue Suns, Crimson Lance. Eclipse didn't use red optics last time he knew. One of them moved forward, partly into the feeble glow coming from one of the overhead glowpot lamps. His armor was black and featureless, which in this setting was as good as having a Genom Covert Ops logo painted on the chest plate in neon orange. Griffin plugged his newly captured combud into his ear and heard a filtered voice say, "Control, X-23 has failed to terminate the objective. Mission time has expired and the weapon is disabled. Request instructions." A pause, then another unfamiliar voice. "Damn," he thought, "it's not Largo." Replied with a paradoxical note of satisfaction, "Well, we knew this day would come sooner or later. Liquidate." "Roger that, Control," said the first voice, and then all the armored figures opened fire. On both of them. Moving on blind instinct, Griffin yanked Ryu no Ha out of the girl's hand, removed Ryu no Tsume from under her chin, and flung himself down on top of her, shielding her almost completely with his body. The scorching agony of blaster fire tearing into his back through the light armor weave of his shirt nearly knocked him cold, but with a grim effort of will he retained enough presence of mind to let go of one sword, draw one of his Briar heavy blasters from under his coat, and fire it, not at any of his myriad attackers, but at the one remaining bent and weakened hinge of the crucible from which the girl had jumped. It took 3 shots to sever the hinge, by which time he was barely hanging on to consciousness, but his persistence was rewarded as the crucible tore free of its mount with a shriek of tearing metal and dropped with a rending crash to the deck below. The overloaded floor collapsed, bearing crucible, deck plates, debris, swords, man, and girl down in a welter of wreckage to some unfathomable abandoned level further below.
"Crazy son of a—"
Griffin heard in his ear, and then everything went black. Wednesday, IPO headquarters. "That was pretty crazy," Scold agreed. Griffin shrugged. "It got them to stop shooting me. That was basically my only goal at the time." Scold nodded, putting the discussion on hold for a moment, and pressed the intercom key. "Laura, prep is complete. Still okay in there?"
"No problems, Dr. Ravenhair,"
Laura replied.
"All right. I'm going to start the initialization sequence. Try not to move. The automed's going to be putting intravenous catheters in both arms, both legs, and your neck. They're just IVs. We're not going all the way to bone like they did in the old days. And it'll only hurt for a second," she added out of habit, remarking to herself that that was a damn silly thing to say to someone who'd once had an arm and both legs cut off in a sword fight. Laura seemed to take it entirely at face value, though, replying without evident irony,
"Thank you, Doctor. I'm ready."
"Okay, here we go."
Scold pressed the green button. "Initialization sequence starts in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. On the automed table, arms moved positioning cuffs to the ends of all 4 of the patient's limbs and her neck, gently stabilizing them, and then, with the quick deftness of an expert nurse captured to the automed's positronic systems from the muscle memory of same, installed IV catheters in all 5 sites. The whole procedure, from needle insertion to retraction, took perhaps a quarter second. Laura didn't even blink.
"All right, looks good," Scold said, looking over the status displays. "Flushing the lines. All lines open and normal. Commencing nanosurgeon infusion now."
She waited a couple of seconds for the status indicators for all 5 lines to go blue, then asked, "Feel anything?"
"It's cold," Laura reported. "No pain, minimal discomfort. Proceed."
Scold smiled at the clinical tone in her patient's voice and, responding with the gravity it deserved, replied,
"Roger, infusion proceeding. First stage process will commence once this batch is fully on board. Estimate 30 minutes.
"Understood."
Scold reached to shut off the intercom, then thought better of it and said, "Since you're not going anywhere for a while, would you care to run a Skillsoft install or two? Might help pass the time. I've got..." She opened a drawer and rummaged around a little. "Knitting, Centauri Drunken Boxing, and How to Draw Comics the Bacon Comics Way."
"Yes, please,"
Laura replied. Scold slotted the first of the Skillsoft modules into the appropriate slot on the automed console, verified that the electrodes were positioned correctly and making good contact, and started the install.
"There you go. Holler if you need anything."
Laura's eyes were already closed and twitching in the REM-like state of a normally proceeding Skillsoft install. She made no reply. Smiling, Scold closed her end of the intercom channel, then turned to Griffin and said,
"So, where were we? You caused a cave-in."
Griffin nodded.
"Yep.
That's one way to solve a problem."
2335 Omega.
"Did you ever have one of those days where you reach a point at which you know, in your innermost heart, in your secret place, that before the day is out, you owe somebody a beating? Yeah. To be absolutely fair, I was having a lot of those in the 2330s, but even so, when I came to in the dark and quiet wreckage of that nameless, forgotten lower level of Omega's 4th District, The very first conclusion I reached was that someone out there was owed a response from my fists in a very big way.
Griffin stirred, groaned, and slowly dragged himself upright, shedding bits of rubble from his back and shoulders. For a second he stood there, rubbing at his face and blinking into the semi-darkness. Then he seemed to remember what he'd been doing to end up down here. He looked down and found his dance partner, out cold but still breathing, and wondered briefly what the hell he was going to do now. Well, he thought, she regenerates, right? By the time she came to, the girl he'd heard called by the codename X-23 had all her relevant parts back more or less where they belonged, and Griffin was mightily impressed with her powers of recuperation. Putting the severed bits back where they went and seeing what happened had been a pretty weak plan, he'd thought, but it had worked like magic. She sat up, blinking in the dim light and feeling at the places where her injuries had been, then extended her claws, rose to an unsteady crouch, and backed away, regarding him warily. "Easy now," he said. "Given what just happened, I don't think we've got any reason to keep fighting. Do you?" She considered this, then retracted her claws and sat down.
"No,"
she admitted almost inaudibly. Griffin nodded, satisfied. "Right. Good." He gestured to their half-collapsed surroundings. "I think we're going to have to work together to get out of here."
"Why?"
she asked. "Because it's a mess down here." Rising from his seat on a chunk of debris, he turned and started examining the tangle of wreckage that formed one pseudo-wall. "This level's been abandoned for centuries."
"No," said X-23. "Why did you save me?"
Griffin hesitated, glancing back at her, then turned back to his investigation of the rubble and said only, "Character flaw." She didn't seem to know what to make of that. After a few minutes, she rose and started helping him search for a path out.
"It took us something like 2 days to find a way out of there, through maintenance ducts that were probably abandoned during the Eisenhower administration, ancient machinery spaces for who knows what, and structural support areas that hadn't seen sapient beings since the original construction crews. The first 12 hours or so, I might as well have been alone. I kept up a running stream of patter, basically just to keep myself from going crazy, and to distract myself from the fact that my back still hurt like hell. I needed a good meal and a solid 9 hours of sleep, and I wasn't going to get either one down here. We were lucky just to have water, after a fashion. At least I think what was in those pipes was water. Then, suddenly, while I was using Ryu no Tsume to clear away a bunch of fallen cables that were blocking our path, she said the first spontaneous thing I'd ever heard her say.
Sensei Tanaka had a sword like that."
Griffin raised an eyebrow. "Had?" he asked.
"He is dead," X-23 replied.
"What happened?" Griffin wondered.
"They made me kill him," she told him tonelessly. "He broke the rules."
Griffin gazed at her with a look of growing concern. "What rules?" he asked, uncertain whether he really wanted to know.
"He was kind to me."
"I see." Griffin frowned thoughtfully, put the sword away, and sat down, César, facing her. Automatically, she adopted the same posture a few feet away.
"I think you had better tell me about it," he said.
Without really understanding why, she did. The story of her life to date didn't take much telling. It hadn't been a very long time, and it was largely made up of the same things happening over and over again. Born in a sterile laboratory, raised from, he would later learn, the very moment of her birth, in an environment deliberately devoid of any but the faintest traces of sapient warmth and kindness, She was indeed a product of exactly the kind of weird science madness he had feared was going on. The only thing he'd been wrong about was that it had been going on for far longer than Largo had been off New Japan. It wasn't a new project. She was, as far as she knew, 15 and had grown normally. So she'd been born in about 2320, and who knew how long it had taken her makers to even get that far. At this point, though, Largo's involvement, or lack thereof, was academic. There were only three people involved with the project of whom she spoke with any emotion at all. One was her sensei, an elderly Neo-Japanese who had begun teaching her several martial arts as soon as she could stand. He had been in the habit of whispering encouragement and praise to her in his native language, and though he was harsh and tough with her in the manner of sensei everywhere, he had also, unlike everyone else around her, recognized her as a child and a human being. So the scientist in charge, a man named Rice, had used some kind of conditioned response trigger to induce her to murder him. Lesson: you are not a person, you are a weapon, and anyone who tells you otherwise will die by your own hand. Strangely, given that he was obviously the chief architect of all her misery, X-23 didn't seem to have any particular response to Rice himself. Perhaps his involvement was just too abstract for her damaged sense of self to take personally. That, Griffin suspected, would change in time. Another one was one of the lead scientists on the project, a geneticist named Kinney. She had never shown any particular warmth for the subject, or presumably the bosses would have had her killed as another object lesson, but she was the only one of the science team who ever seemed to care what happened to her to any extent. This often led her into subtle conflicts X-23 sensed, but only vaguely understood, with Dr. Rice, but Kinney evidently had always backed off when push came to shove, since she was still alive. It was a pretty sad state of affairs, Griffin thought, when that was the best a person could expect to do in terms of anybody giving a damn. Well, and a bit in spite of himself, now he gave a damn, and there were a bunch of people who were going to have cause to regret that he did, particularly in light of what she'd told him about the third person. After observing all that she had told him and contemplating it all for several silent minutes, he asked, "Listen, do you think you can find this facility again?" "Of course," said X-23 without hesitation. "Good. When we get out of here, I want you to show me the way there." She looked puzzled. "Why?" "Because I'm going to destroy it," he said flatly. That only seemed to confuse her more. "Why?" she eventually repeated. Griffin got to his feet, wincing only slightly, and turned back to the task of chopping the cables out of their way. "Because I can, and somebody has to."